Judaism is not extrinsic to us. It is intrinsic to our own faith. That's why Pope John Paul II declared the Jewish people to be our brothers in faith.
A leading Catholic voice helps set the record straight about the relationship between Jews and Catholics as a debate about anti-Semitism explodes into the public square. Following the example of Pope Leo, after the cutoff of SNAP nutrition assistance for low-income Americans, we look to Peru for a Christian witness of what our Holy Father did to make sure the hungry were nourished.
Me.
There's no closure yet, you know, because eventually they know there's still something else to do.
And bringing closure to both cremated loved ones and their family members. We visit a unique Catholic mission devoted to the proper burial of those who are cremated to find out what relatives should know. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Nostra Aetate makes it very clear that Jew hatred is hatred of Christ, because Christ cannot be understood outside his Jewish self-understanding.
Renowned Catholic scholar George Weigel reflects on a pivotal church document that forever clarified the shared inheritance between Judaism and Catholicism. Amid rising acts of hostility against Jews, the church remains unequivocal. Hatred towards the Jewish people is a grave sin. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Anti-Semitism can be defined as dehumanizing and hostile beliefs and behaviors that target Jews because of their Jewish identity. It can include violence and harassment or be spread through myths and stereotypes. It is a centuries-old hatred, but cases of anti-Semitism have surged in the United States recently, particularly since the Hamas terrorist attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, and the start of the Israel-Hamas war. In fact, 2024 saw the highest amount of anti-Semitic incidents since the Anti-Defamation League began tracking them nearly 50 years ago. For perspective, there were nearly 3,700 anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. in 2022. In 2023, that number more than doubled to nearly 8,900. In 2024, it rose past 9,000. That's an 893% increase of anti-Semitic attacks in the U.S. over the last decade. That hostility towards the Jewish people is also creeping up in some Catholic circles, being espoused by increasingly influential voices who use their faith to justify their hateful beliefs.
They're even lying about the history of the Star of David. It's a hexagram. It's a cult.
Catholic convert Candace Owens is one of the most popular podcasters in the U.S. today. Her show sits towards the top of the podcast charts. With such a large audience, it's all the more alarming then that Owens has been peddling an increasing number of shocking anti-Semitic conspiracy theories.
What you want them to comply with in this case is Germany, Nazi, Hitler, the greatest evil that's ever happened on Earth, even though factually and statistically it is not.
It's like a transnational gang. And what they have in common, what binds them together, is their Jewish identity.
Nick Fuentes may be the most infamous self-declared anti-Semite online personality today. He also positions himself as a voice for traditional Catholics.
If you've read the Church Fathers on this, the Catholics do not believe that Jews are like, awesome.
American political conservative commentator Tucker Carlson recently interviewed Nick Fuentes on his show, immediately prompting backlash for giving Fuentes a major platform and with little to no pushback to his anti-Semitic ideology. The Catholic president of the powerful conservative organization, the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, decided to defend Carlson's decision in a video released last week.
I disagree with and even abhor things that Nick Fuentes says. But canceling him is not the answer either.
He's since apologized, but it's caused an uproar and has put a spotlight on whether anti-Semitism is being increasingly accepted and normalized in some conservative and Christian circles.
You have a lot of young men who, having rejected establishmentarian view of American politics and the way it works, have been led by certain influencers into taking up these conspiracy theories about Jewish people and their influence.
Mene Ukweburua is a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board, which this week published an editorial titled "The New Right's New Anti-Semites," pleading with conservatives to call out an old political poison growing on the new right.
Our goal is that if we call attention to it and fight it right now, hopefully it will prevent more parts of the U.S. conservative movement from going down that path.
Also in the news, and what's either blatant anti-Semitism or pure ignorance and with failed oversight, Bishop Timothy Sr. of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, denounced last week that a local Catholic school included a replica of the Auschwitz concentration camp gate on its float for the town's annual Halloween parade. The float's designer has since apologized, saying it was his artistic interpretation on how none of us get out of this life alive. Bishop Sr. called it offensive and unacceptable.
There's something weird and mysterious about anti-Semitism. It never seems to go away. Every time we think we've got that vampire buried with a stake through its heart, somehow it rises again.
Dr. Robert George, a scholar at Princeton University and prominent religious freedom advocate, has been one of the most outspoken Catholic leaders against the creeping rise of anti-Semitism, including among Catholics themselves.
Catholics should know better. At this stage, Catholics have no excuse for not knowing better. But nevertheless, they will sometimes even wrap their anti-Semitism in a garment of fidelity to Catholic teaching.
It is a disturbing time to live in, not just because of the resurgence of anti-Semitism, but the extent to which that has poisoned at least elements of the Catholic faithful.
Dr. Richard Crane, a Catholic historian at Benedictine College who specializes in anti-Semitism, explains that a strain of anti-Semitism among some groups of Catholics today is connected to the idea that Vatican II was a mistake and not guided by the Holy Spirit.
The idea that Vatican II and its reforms, not limited to Nostra Aetate, but especially Nostra Aetate, was part of some Jewish Masonic plot. Unfortunately, quote-unquote Catholic influencers, such as Candace Owens and Nick Fuentes, they are making this up out of whole cloth, but the script has been written, and it never entirely went away within the church.
It was at the end of Vatican II in 1965 that the Catholic Church released the document Nostra Aetate, marking a major turning point in the church's approach and relations with other faith traditions.
It recognizes Christianity's distinctive truth claims, but at the same time, it recognizes explicitly, I'm using the document's words, not my own, all that is true and holy, all that is good in the other religions of the world.
In Nostra Aetate, meaning in our times, the church declared Christians and Jews share a spiritual patrimony. God did not withdraw his blessing on the Jewish people. It repudiates the idea Jews are collectively responsible for Christ's crucifixion, and it was the first formal denunciation of anti-Semitism. The document states, the church, mindful of the patrimony she shares with the Jews and moved not by political reasons, but by the gospel's spiritual love, decries hatred, persecutions, displays of anti-Semitism directed against Jews at any time and by anyone.
Non possiamo negare.
Pope Leo XIV is carrying on the church's stance, strongly condemning anti-Semitism last Wednesday when he dedicated his general audience to Nostra Aetate's 60th anniversary last week.
And so I too confirm that the church does not tolerate anti-Semitism and fights against it on the basis of the gospel itself.
I think the Jewish community in America understands itself beyond itself, meaning that we are a kind of barometer of the civic health of the nation.
Dr. Jonathan Silver, senior vice president of the Jewish educational nonprofit, the Tikva Fund, has been watching the heated rhetoric towards the Jewish people with alarm. He's convinced it will take both Catholics and Jews to lean into our biblical inheritance together to combat the anti-Semitism of today.
So much of the anti-Semitism that we've seen, after all, is motivated by an attempt to re-paganize the culture. This is something surely that Catholics and Jews together can try to work against.
How should Catholics contend with the spread of anti-Semitic rhetoric seeping into mainstream platforms today for the sake of our Jewish brothers and sisters and for the sake of our own soul? We are joined by a guest who provides a thoughtful perspective on the Catholic response to anti-Semitism and how the Church can confront this age-old hatred. Mary Eberstadt is a founder of the Coalition of Catholics Against Anti-Semitism, a leading Catholic author of several acclaimed books, and a social commentator known for her analysis of faith, culture, and the modern world. Mary holds the Panula Chair in Christian Culture at the Catholic Information Center and is a senior research fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute. Mary, thank you so much for joining us for this important discussion. First, I just want to ask for your observations right now about the uptick of anti-Semitic rhetoric that we're seeing online and how we as Catholics must grapple with that. How would you describe this moment that we are in?
Well, thank you for having me, Catherine. And first of all, I'd like to say anti-Semitism, as you note, is an ancient evil, but it has acquired new life online, like other ancient evils that have acquired new life online. And I think it's very important for Catholics not only to do the right thing here and avoid this evil, but even more, to take the lead in fighting against it. And the reason I say that is that Catholic teaching, as we have heard, is unbroken, firm, and unsparing about this particular sin.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, incidents of anti-Semitism have surged since the October 7th Hamas attack in Israel. And there are some who would say that the anti-Semitic label is used too broadly for anyone who offers any critique of the state of Israel and its actions. Can you clarify what anti-Semitism is and what it is not as it pertains to our stance as Catholics towards Israel?
Well, I can first say, how do you recognize anti-Semitism? How do you know it when you see it? First of all, you know it when people talk about the Jews. The Jews is a stereotype, a noxious stereotype. You know you're looking at anti-Semitism when people are blaming social dissolution and other problems on, quote, the Jews. Now, how do we distinguish this from Israeli foreign policy? It seems to me it's pretty easy. Catholics are heirs to a tradition of just war theory. And the interesting thing about people who say that Israel is in the wrong is that the kinds of anti-Semites who are making that case never stop to talk about just war theory. Under just war theory, nations that are attacked and people who are attacked have the right to defend themselves. I have yet to see from any anti-Semitic quarter the argument that what Israel is doing violates just war theory. So in other words, what I'm saying is that people are not intellectually serious about saying there's a conflation going on between anti-Semitism and second thoughts about what the Israelis are doing. That's not a serious argument.
You have called anti-Semitism the new pornography because it degrades its users. Can you expand on that point?
Yes, of course. It bears several similarities to pornography. Number one, it is usually online, committed furtively, anonymously, and there's a seediness about it. The other thing it has in common with pornography is that when this kind of consumption comes to light, people are invariably embarrassed by it, ashamed of it, wish they hadn't done it, are ridiculed for it. And that's what I mean in saying that this is moral pornography. And I want to emphasize that message to Catholics in particular. Because Catholics took the lead back when hardly anyone else was doing it in saying that pornography is wrong, it's bad, it's something you should stay away from. And a lot of us were ridiculed in the public square for making those kinds of arguments. That's why I say again, Catholics need to be in the lead of fighting against anti-Semitism, because this online anti-Semitism bears such a resemblance to pornography online.
When it comes to this subject, Mary, there is a major online debate about whether declaring the phrase "Christ is King" is an attack on our Jewish brothers and sisters. This is what Catholic scholar Dr. Robert George told me this week.
we believe Christ is King. Definitely. There's no question about that. And when we proclaim Christ as King as a statement of our faith, we say what is true, and we honor Jesus Christ as the Son of God, our Savior, second person of the Blessed Trinity. But when anybody, Catholic or not, uses that wonderful truth, that wonderful phrase, Christ is King, as a taunt, as a way to express contempt for other people, to express hatred for Jewish people, when it becomes a taunt, that is blasphemy. That is taking something holy and debasing and degrading it, using it for immoral and wicked purposes.
Mary, can you comment on this point and this debate? This seems to really be at the crux of a lot of tension there. How do we as Catholics move forward in the Great Commission and proclaiming the gospel while maintaining relationship properly with our Jewish brothers and sisters?
Well, as always, it's very hard to improve on Professor George, and I am not able to do it, but I am able to observe that it is hard to think of anything more diabolical and transgressive than taking that phrase, Christ is King, and using it as an anti-Semitic taunt. It almost seems unimaginable that we have to remind people that Jesus was born a Jew, lived as a Jew, lived in a Jewish family with Jewish traditions, etc., etc. What would Jesus do about this is a question that Catholics need to ask themselves.
That being said, can you, Mary, put into perspective for us how seismic the Vatican II document Nostra Aetate is for our church as we celebrate 60 years now since its release?
Yes, it was seismic in the sense that it was a clarification of teaching that is, again, unsparing and unconditional. No acts of anti-Semitism are permissible by anyone at any time. No amount of sophistical reasoning or online trolling can get around those words. It's blanket. It's absolute. And it was followed by a number of strong statements by Catholic leaders reiterating what is said in Nostra Aetate, one of which is the Venerable Fulton Sheen, who was then Bishop of Rochester, and went out of his way time and again to reiterate that to be anti-Semitic is to be anti-Christian. That is a direct quote. Later, we had John Paul II and a succession of leaders, as George Weigel alluded to, saying the same thing. So again, there is no wiggle room for Catholics in this matter.
Mary Eberstadt, thank you for your clarity and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Catherine.
Thank you. There's much more to come on this edition of EWTN News In Depth.
Acá en el comedor es como una familia.
She says, here in the soup kitchen, it's like a family. And as we hear about an interruption of SNAP food benefits for millions of people across America, we travel to Peru to find out what would Pope Leo do.
What you may want for this particular person's ashes may not be what generations after you leave will want.
And therein lies the problem.
And there lies the problem. So they'll be disposed of or just discarded and no one will know.
And a proper Christian burial for those who choose cremation. A little later, important information from a Catholic cemetery ministry. Grateful prayers before a nutritious meal in Chiclayo, Peru. The patrons are local townspeople. The chefs are neighborhood women. And the food establishment is called Pope Leo XIV's Soup Kitchen. A look at Pope Leo's hunger solution in a moment, but first an update on the interruption of SNAP food stamp benefits for Americans. Last weekend, nutrition assistance for 42 million people was cut off for the first time since the Food Stamp Act passed in 1964. And no other government shutdown has the safety net program not been funded. SNAP benefits go to low-income Americans, most of whom have incomes below the federal poverty level. Across the country, nonprofits, church groups, and other public partnerships have tried to fill the gap as best they can by offering groceries through food pantries and distribution centers to people who need food. That includes cut-off SNAP recipients and an increasing number of federal workers who have not received a full paycheck in more than a month because of government paralysis in Washington.
My message to the people in Washington would be just to get it together. We need to all work together. Regardless of whose side we're on, we all need to work together as people, human beings.
We're definitely not political, and we don't believe this should be a political issue. That children are hungry, we should feed them no matter which party you're in.
In the meantime, a federal judge is trying to get SNAP funds moving again. That judge in Rhode Island last week ordered the Trump administration to release $6 billion in contingency SNAP funds being held by the Agriculture Department. The White House pledged to release it soon, even if the money would only fund parts of this month's SNAP benefit. Few benefits have been paid out yet. This week, that judge rejected the administration's plan. He said the administration is withholding the money for political reasons, that partial funding is not good enough, and continued disruptions are unacceptable. He ordered full funding for November to be released immediately, using additional funds available from other government accounts. Within an hour of the order, the administration announced it would appeal. As the legal battle over SNAP continues, you can help Catholic Charities USA and its affiliates across the country feed families most impacted by the shutdown. Learn more and make your donation at ccusa.online/shutdown. As Catholics, we are called to care for the poor and those in need, just as Jesus encountered the most vulnerable during his earthly ministry. It's a call the Holy Father focused on in the first major writing of his pontificate, released early October. In his apostolic exhortation, De Lexi Te, Latin for I have loved you, Pope Leo writes, "Love for the poor, whatever the form their poverty may take, is the evangelical hallmark of a church faithful to the heart of God. No Christian can regard the poor simply as a societal problem. They are part of our family. They are one of us." When personally confronted with the poor and hungry, what has Pope Leo XIV himself done? Our colleague Jonathan Liddle, senior editor at the National Catholic Register, recently returned from a trip to Peru to document the life of then Bishop Robert Prevost during his two decades of missionary service there. From that trip, we have a concrete example of Pope Leo putting his faith into action at what is now named the Pope Leo XIV's Soup Kitchen in Chiclayo, Peru.
It's lunchtime in Chiclayo, Peru. And folks are sitting down to eat at this soup kitchen, named in honor of the former local bishop, Pope Leo XIV. Located at Mary Queen of Priests Chapel, in a poorer part of town, the Pope Leo XIV soup kitchen serves those in need, providing a warm meal, but so much more.
Acá en el comedor es como una familia. Agradezco a todos, a las hermanitas, por tener tanta paciencia.
But Pope Leo isn't just the soup kitchen's namesake. He's also its founder and is remembered by volunteers like head cook Rosita Ruiz Gomez as not just a supporter, but a friend.
¿Cómo le puedo decir una persona tan humilde, tan sencilla que era uno, cuando él estaba junto con nosotros, era uno más de nosotros? No era el obispo. No, era uno más de nosotros.
The man known then as Bishop Robert Prevost founded the soup kitchen in 2019, one of several he started during his 9 years in Chiclayo. The goal was to help the poor in a region where the average household lives off of less than $400 a month, and to meet the needs of immigrants from Venezuela who had come to Peru seeking a better life but faced severe poverty. When funding for the soup kitchen came up short, Pope Leo contributed personally, and even got the local military to help out with construction. The future Pope blessed the soup kitchen at its grand opening, and even celebrated one of his birthdays here with the people he loved so much.
Él, como digo, pues no, él no vio que estaba lejos, estaba de polvo, no. Él vino, lo bendijo, se confundió con nosotros, de verdad.
What's being served up at Pope Leo's soup kitchen today?
What do we have for lunch?
Hoy tenemos por almuerzo una sopa de sémola con menudencia, que se llama arroz con pollo, que el arroz con pollo está hecho con alverjas, choclo, zanahoria, ¿cómo se llama? Pimiento, y el pollo. Se va juntando, vamos a servir por hoy.
The meal begins with a prayer.
En el nombre del Padre, del Hijo y del Espíritu Santo. Vamos, hermanos, sírvanse.
And provides for about 80 guests a day. All are welcome, from the elderly to the young. Guests are asked to contribute a small amount, but if they can't, they eat for free. Local restaurants, prompted by the former bishop, also donate food. And the tasty Peruvian dishes are served with a smile.
Mi madre tenía, me enseñó que hay que colaborar, hay que ayudar con los que más necesitan. Porque nosotros tenemos muchos hermanos que necesitan, muchos.
The Soup Kitchen is part of Hope Leo's larger legacy of care for the poor in Chiclayo.
Siempre nos enseñó desde el Caritas, que su mismo nombre lo dice, la caridad, la caricia de la Madre Iglesia a sus hijos, siempre nos enseñó a estar cerca y compadecernos del dolor de la gente.
Yanina Sosa was the director of diocesan charities under Bishop Prevost. She says he led by example, helping out during El Nino flooding, securing oxygen facilities during COVID, and even dishing up meals himself. Sosa says Pope Leo always emphasized the connection between prayer and service.
A nosotros siempre nos decía el equipo de Caritas, ¿no? Es importante lo espiritual, es importante la formación, porque también se preocupaba por nosotros, pero es muy importante el salir a ayudar a las personas en el momento que se nos necesite.
And she says that for Pope Leo, it wasn't just about serving the poor, but also learning from them.
Como él decía, los pobres nos evangelizan. Y es cierto, a él le gustaba ir mucho a las comunidades de los pueblos, a las zonas alejadas, porque veía la riqueza de las personas que quizás no tenían lo material, pero eran muy acogedores, muy cariñosos.
It's a message that the former bishop of Chiclayo is now sharing as the supreme pontiff in Rome.
Siamo la Chiesa del Signore, una Chiesa di poveri, tutti preziosi, tutti soggetti, ognuno portatore di una parola singolare di Dio.
Pope Leo's first major document, the Lexi Te, urged Catholics to focus on loving the poor, calling it an essential path to holiness and a requirement of true worship.
León 14.
Bishop Edinson Farfán is Pope Leo's successor in Chiclayo. He told us that the Pope's experience with the poor of Peru helped shape the Vatican document.
Este libro, esta reflexión o esta exhortación ya venía siendo trabajada por Francisco. Él pone su toque especial y su experiencia de misionero en el Perú.
Pope Leo's care for the needy continues to inspire Catholics in Chiclayo today. Voices of Help, a new charity, runs after-school programming for kids with limited resources. The focus is on building new skills and, above all, instilling a love of reading.
Reforzar a los niños para mejorar su educación, mejorarlos en su vida misma. Es un orgullo para nosotros seguir con la labor del Papa.
It's a project with a sweet source of funding. Proceeds from the sale of Papaleta, Pope Leo XIV-shaped popsicles.
Rico.
And back at the soup kitchen that bears his name, volunteers continue to follow Pope Leo's example, loving the poor, one meal at a time.
Yo sé que se siente orgulloso. Yo sé que se siente orgulloso porque no hemos dejado. Su meta era ayudar. Entonces nosotros acá con las hermanas seguimos ayudando. Bajo nuestras posibilidades, seguimos ayudando.
From Chiclayo, Peru, I'm Jonathan Liddle, EWTN News in depth.
Pope Leo puts not only an emphasis on how we should treat the poor, but this week also spoke about how Christians should receive the foreigner. He was asked about the controversial ICE detentions of immigrants in the United States and the lack of pastoral care they are receiving. ICE has recently blocked requests by some Catholic priests to bring the Eucharist to detainees.
Many people who've lived for years and years and years, never causing problems, have been deeply affected by what's going on right now. The spiritual rights of people who have been detained should also be considered, and I would certainly invite the authorities to allow pastoral workers to attend to the needs of those people.
Pope Leo made the remarks to reporters on Tuesday as he was headed back to the Vatican from Castel Gandolfo. In appealing for sacramental ministry for detainees, the Pope said these immigrants are often separated from their families for long periods, and advocates say denying pastoral care only exacerbates their hardship and uncertainty. Just a day later, in the Pope's hometown of Chicago, a federal judge issued a temporary restraining order requiring ICE officials to improve prison-like conditions at the de facto Broadview Detention Center. Detainees must be allowed food, clean bedding, and water, as well as access to prescribed medications and private communication with a lawyer. The judge said the detainees, who were crammed into a single cell by the dozens with no hot food or anywhere to sleep, are suffering irreparable harm. Then on Thursday, federal judge Sarah Ellis issued an injunction restricting federal agents' use of force against protesters and reporters, saying the officers are unnecessarily terrorizing local residents seeking to peacefully protest or document their actions. According to the order, Border Patrol Commander Gregory Bovino, who leads the immigration crackdown and has defended agents' use of force, repeatedly lied about threats posed by protesters and reporters. Ellis has repeatedly chastised the agents for not following her previous orders, including a ban on riot control techniques and a requirement to wear body cameras. We hit an infamous milestone as the government shutdown becomes the longest in American history. And major slowdowns are about to hit an airport near you. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. And then beyond the soup kitchen, we show you another faith-filled example of neighbor helping neighbor.
A firefighter and his so-called furniture project are helping the needy and inspiring solidarity. I'm Alan Holdren in Omaha, Nebraska. That story coming up.
We enter the seventh week of the government shutdown, the longest shutdown in U.S. history. That unfortunate record tops the Week in Review. Senate Republicans are working on a long-shot deal to get enough Senate moderate Democrats to join them in voting to reopen the government. House Speaker Mike Johnson has kept the House of Representatives closed for six full weeks. Congressmen are still collecting their paychecks while taking no votes, doing no committee or oversight work, and entering into no negotiations.
This is day 37 of the Trump Republican shutdown. And the position of House Democrats remains the same. We will not support a partisan Republican spending bill that continues to gut the health care of the American people. We're ready, we're willing, we're able to sit down with our Republican colleagues anytime, any place, in order to reopen the government, to find a bipartisan path forward, and to decisively address the Republican health care crisis that continues to crush people all across the country. Tens of millions of Americans who are in the open enrollment period right now are seeing their premiums, copays, and deductibles skyrocket, in some cases, by $1,000 or $2,000 per month. That is unsustainable.
This is day 37. 37. It seems unbelievable to us that we've gone this long. It is officially and shamefully the longest shutdown in U.S. history. Republicans feel very helpless about the situation because, as we've noted, there is really nothing for us to negotiate. We sent them a clean CR, as you know, back in September, September 19th. We passed it out of the House. It feels like a lifetime ago. But that was a nonpartisan measure. It was 24 pages in length. It has no Republican priorities on it at all. It was merely the status quo to keep the lights on so that the members of Congress and the Republican and Democrat Party could work together to finish the government funding appropriations process. And the Democrats tried to turn that into a game. I'm not promising anybody anything. I'm going to let this process play out.
And while the shutdown impasse continues, the fallout threatens to cause chaos at the nation's airports. Beginning this weekend, the FAA has ordered airlines to gradually reduce domestic flights by 10% from 40 high-volume airports across the country, citing air traffic controller shortages. On Friday, more than 800 flights were canceled. The move could also spell trouble for the Thanksgiving holiday, when a record number of Americans are expected to travel. The FAA claims the order is necessary for traveler safety because the shutdown is taking a toll on air traffic controllers, who have only received one partial paycheck since October 1st.
And that short staffing is in the busiest areas, New York, the East Coast, Florida, West Coast, and any kind of delays or cancellations ripple across the whole system. So even a 10% reduction can be exponential, you know, just because you can add one airplane to a 5 or a 6 or a 7 airplane problem, and it can be make it much more difficult. So that will help.
Most controllers work mandatory overtime 6 days a week. Hundreds have called in sick since the shutdown began, and some have even resigned. But administration critics and some air traffic controllers say the unprecedented FAA order is more about politics than safety and is a pressure tactic to end the government shutdown. President Trump's sweeping tariffs, a key part of his economic agenda, took center stage at the Supreme Court on Wednesday. The case not only has major economic stakes, but is the biggest case on the potential limits of presidential power this term. Within his first 90 days in office, Trump enacted emergency tariffs on virtually all goods imported into the U.S. without congressional approval. The administration has justified the levies by citing the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEPA, which gives the president broad economic powers during an emergency. Numerous small businesses and a group of states who brought the case say IEPA does not mention taxes or tariffs, and that the tariffs are an overreach of presidential power. The justices, including key conservatives on the bench, seemed skeptical of the administration's tariffs.
These are kind of across the board. And so is it your contention that every country needed to be tariffed because of threats to the defense and industrial base? I mean, Spain, France. I
think this is a question for the other side as well. It's two-facing. Yes, of course, tariffs and dealings with foreign powers. But the vehicle is imposition of taxes on Americans. And that has always been the core power of Congress.
The justices have fast-tracked the case, and some court watchers say their ruling could come as early as this year, well before the end of the term. This is one of the most significant economic cases in front of the court in years. As of September, American businesses and consumers have paid nearly $90 billion to cover the tariffs in question. Florida's attorney general announced on Thursday he is suing Planned Parenthood for misrepresenting the safety of the chemical abortion drug mifepristone. It's estimated to be a $354 million lawsuit. Florida says our nation's largest abortion business is exploiting patient trust by making false claims over abortion drug safety. In an exclusive interview on the lawsuit, I sat down with Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer, a practicing Catholic, to hear more on the case and how the state of Florida has seen how dangerous abortion pills can be.
A couple months ago, we joined a lawsuit working with the state of Texas, and other states are coming on board suing mifepristone and drug providers directly because of these harms. And the nature of these pills is it's easier for them to get mailed into states like Florida, where we have a heartbeat bill, and they can violate that law. Mm-hmm. They also are more easily into the hands of kids as a result of these new practices. So we want to hold people accountable for hurting our women, for hurting our children, and these lawsuits are seeking to do it. Planned Parenthood, you know, they had some other services they were providing that were actually more helpful. Cancer screenings, they don't do many of those anymore. Instead, they've turned to the chemical abortion pills because they're so profitable. They have a 500% profit margin on the sale of these dangerous products.
Uthmeyer tells me he does not expect Planned Parenthood will pay the $354 million they are requesting, and he is ready to fight this issue in court. You can watch the entirety of my exclusive interview with Florida's attorney general on this major Planned Parenthood lawsuit at the EWTN News YouTube page. A date has been set for the funeral of Vice President Dick Cheney, who passed away Monday night at the age of 84. A no-nonsense conservative, he was one of the most consequential vice presidents in modern U.S. history. Cheney was vice president to George W. Bush from 2001 to 2009, but he had a decades-long career in Washington before then, serving as White House chief of staff to Gerald Ford, defense secretary, and a multi-term congressman from Wyoming. As the chief architect of the War on Terror, he played an instrumental role in deploying troops to Afghanistan and Iraq after 9/11. Cheney is survived by his wife of 61 years, Lynn, as well as his daughters, Liz and Mary. Liz followed in her father's footsteps by entering politics as a Republican member of Congress and joined her father in recent years, strongly opposing election denialism. His memorial service will take place on Thursday, November 20th, at the Washington National Cathedral.
There are people suffering in all of our communities. We must find a way to serve them and to help them. Humbly.
Life as a firefighter took him into other people's homes. Next, how his deep Catholic faith inspired him to step forward to help fill the needs he saw. We'll be right back. We turn now to another concrete example of how we as Catholics can help those in need, as expressed by Pope Leo's apostolic exhortation, Dilexe Te. Reporter Alan Holdren tells us about an operation in Omaha, Nebraska, focused on bringing hope by carrying out corporal works of mercy one home at a time.
Meet Omaha, Nebraska firefighter Drew Gerken. Firefighters rescue people. They save. They serve. They protect. Drew goes beyond that. He provides. It all started in 2013 when he made a house call.
There were three children and two adults and no furniture. There wasn't a chair to sit in, a mattress to lay on, a plate to eat off of. There was nothing in there. So I asked one of the children, I said, "Where do you sleep?" And he showed me into one of the rooms where in three of the corners they had piled their clothes. He said, "We take our things out of our bag and we lay on top of our clothes."
Gerken took matters into his own hands.
I was really tired of this idea that, well, that's too bad, but there's nothing we can do about it. So we reached out via social media to the community, and by the end of that shift, had basically been offered what we were going to need to help that family.
Now, a dozen years later, Gerken's nonprofit is rolling, furnishing 30 to 40 households per week, serving 1,600 families last year alone, at no cost to clients. His faith inspired it all.
When we were little kids, our parents hand us a book of the stories of the saints, and we read and learn about these heroes of the faith, right? Well, those people made difficult decisions. They took a stand. They set themselves apart through their courage and through their sacrifice. I certainly do not consider myself on par with them, but it's that example that I think guides us and tells us that this service is not optional. This is our duty to our community. It's the price we pay for what we hope is our eternal salvation. When we see someone suffering, when we encounter an injustice, it's our duty to act. But it's not about the furniture. The work that we do here is about the people. It's about neighbors helping neighbors.
Hello, how are you guys?
All of this is destined to be given away. It's been donated by people, businesses, and organizations in the Omaha metro area to be shared with people in Omaha and the surrounding communities. Since it began, the Furniture Project has served more than 4,500 families. That just goes to show that one person with a heart for charity can impact so many lives.
He just did it out of his garage with his pickup truck for a long time. And now it's this big warehouse and trucks and supporters and benefactors. And it all grew out of just his feeling that if he didn't do it, who would?
So when he's not fighting fires, he spends much of his time here at the warehouse, furnishing homes.
We treat people with respect. And I think that whole environment that's been created here comes through through Drew. What we're doing is all about community building. If you talk to Drew, it seems like he knows everyone in Omaha, and I think that's why we're here, you know? It's all of those connections that are so important.
This work serves some of the more than 60,000 Omaha residents that live below the poverty line. The need is real, and a core of 10 full-time staff, 50 regular volunteers, and 225 partnering agencies now work through this project to serve them. While people sometimes receive items directly, much is done by the volunteers and through intermediaries, like New Vision Homeless Services, through which this load is destined to a family in need.
We get to show them a new furnished apartment, something that they may have not seen in years or may have never seen before ever. And it gives them a sense of pride and hope and encouragement that, you know, we had a bad past, but the future is looking bright.
Etu is one of the crew here. He's a refugee himself, like many of the families the Furniture Project serves. Through the work, he delivers a message to those they help.
We want you to feel love. We want you to feel welcome in a community so, you know, we can provide you with these things so that you can better support your family or yourself so that you can help back the community.
It seems so easy, and yet it takes a person with the faith to follow the inspiration, the hope to reach out for help, and the love to share all of God's gifts with others. In Omaha, Nebraska, Alan Holdren, EWTN News in Depth.
Next, we turn to All Saints and All Souls. From the Vatican and a remembrance of the late Pope Francis, to your photo submissions of the little saints in your house, to the serious side of a Catholic mission devoted to the proper burial of those who are cremated.
More and more people are being cremated, less and less are being buried, therefore there's a lot of urns somewhere.
Information about a unique Catholic mission and the people who take the opportunity to honor their loved ones with a proper Christian burial. Our All Saints and All Souls Day review when we return. A beautiful moment of prayer for the faithful departed. On Monday, Pope Leo offered a requiem mass in St. Peter's Basilica in suffrage for cardinals and bishops who passed away in the last year, including his predecessor, the late Pope Francis. In the evening, the Holy Father visited Francis's grave in the Basilica of St. Mary Major. There, he laid a bouquet of white roses, a nod to the late pontiff's devotion to St. Therese of Lisieux. Last Sunday marked the commemoration of All the Faithful Departed, or All Souls Day. Pope Leo honored this special day by carrying on Francis's tradition of saying Mass in a cemetery.
We have gathered here to celebrate the commemoration of all the faithful departed. We do so especially for those buried in this place, and with particular affection for our own loved ones. Although they left us the day when they died, we continue to carry them with us in our hearts, and their memory remains always alive within us amid our daily lives.
Pope Leo continued his homily in Verano Cemetery by encouraging those mourning a loved one to turn to the risen Christ for comfort. He emphasized that Catholics must contemplate death as a hope for the future and not just a recollection of the past. Those mourning a loved one are usually the very people who see to it that the deceased person's human remains are properly buried. But with an increasing number of cremations comes an increasing number of questions about what exactly constitutes the proper burial of human ashes. On the occasion of this year's All Souls Day, we take a look at a unique Catholic apostolate leading the way on this issue. Mark Irons has this Catholic Life report.
Grant that through this mystery, these servants who have gone to their rest in Christ may share in the joy of Christ's resurrection.
Cemeteries offer stone reminders of two things, death and burial. One is certain, the other not so much. These days, cremation is becoming more and more prevalent, but the burial of ashes in a cemetery is no guarantee. So today,
we can rest now that she's in a safe, secure place.
Some closure comes to this small group of unrelated people.
This is something sacred.
Who joined together at Holy Cross Cemetery in Baltimore, Maryland to finally lay their loved ones to rest.
And we were so, so happy to find it.
The Catholic Church permits cremation as long as it's not done as a denial of faith in the resurrection of the body, and as long as the ashes are buried in a sacred place, like the consecrated ground of this cemetery.
We commend our brothers and sisters in the sure and certain hope that together with all who have died in Christ, they will rise with Christ on the last day.
Baltimore priest Father Patrick Carrion presides over this unique ministry named after the 14th station of the cross.
Obviously, you know, the 14th station is Jesus is buried.
During the year, notices are sent out to Baltimore parishioners to bring the urns containing the ashes of their loved ones that for one reason or another have not been buried. Those reasons might include a hard time letting go, an inability to cover traditional burial cost, or misunderstandings about church teaching. There is a nominal fee, but sometimes it's waived. Those being buried don't have to be Catholic.
Let's create an opportunity for them to bury them, you know, to allow that closure to be there.
Anywhere from 15 to 50 urns are collected throughout the year and secured and sealed in a new vault like this one. Then on All Souls Day in early November, a proper Christian burial is provided. A gravestone is later placed in commemoration. This year, 18 people were buried, each with a story of their own.
She's a beautiful woman. I think this is very fitting and timely.
She deserved this.
Yeah. Everybody deserves it.
First cousins Leonidas Newton and Denise France buried their Aunt Moselle and wife of the family gatherings, who passed away in 2017. Denise had seen this ministry advertised in a church bulletin years ago, but various circumstances prevented her from proceeding. Then COVID hit and brought further delays. A couple weeks ago, she rediscovered the ministry and annual burial.
Needless to say, I knew it was something we had to do as a family.
Tim McCarthy was a caretaker of Kathy Gately, who passed away last year. Burial was delayed due to the health of Kathy's sister.
The ashes were with her sister for a period of time, who was very sick. And then when she got back on her feet, we set this up and we did it as soon as we could.
Why does the church care about the way bodily remains are preserved and buried?
Because they see the sanctity of life from the moment of conception, you know, to death. But then also how we treat our dead speaks about something about life in itself. You know, the sanctity, the image of God dwelling within that person all their lives. Therefore, to respect that person by giving them a dignified burial.
Father Carrion says a problem arises when people decide to hold on to ashes, scatter them, or divide them among relatives.
The dividing the ashes up, and today you can go make that into a piece of jewelry or put the ashes in a locket around your neck. You put it on the mantelpiece in a smaller, you know, urn. You're really taking a particular person and making them now a possession. And I think there's a moral issue to that.
Visiting a cemetery like this one can remind us to pray for those who are laid to rest here. And in the month of November, the church asked the faithful to pray for departed souls in purgatory, many of whom could be forgotten and in great need of prayer.
When they're buried in the cemetery, you see the bridge from this life to the next life. Whereas if they're in an urn, it's kind of like keeping them, it's just very, very earthly.
Bonnie Sammons told me her Catholic family initially faced friction from a close friend of her brother Tony, who passed away in August, when the friend wanted to keep Tony's ashes, but the family pushed back.
She was just hurt and sad, and you know, she was thinking that was a way of keeping him, but we all know that we are not, you know, as a practicing Catholic, we know that we are, this is not our permanent home, and that we have to respect the body.
Robert Seelig, CEO of Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services, says current data suggests there is what he calls an epidemic.
You now have literally hundreds, if not thousands, of cremated remains, family members, being retained at home where family members don't know what to do with them. Oftentimes, when you talk to a bishop or a priest, they'll lament the fact that sometimes their parishioners aren't having a funeral, at the parish, or that the remains aren't being brought to the cemeteries. And the real question is, how do we mobilize and go out and kind of reach out to the margins where families are hurting?
He says ministries like the one in Baltimore and others started by his organization in around 30 other dioceses offer a solution to the problem, but there is still much work to do.
We find the corporal work of Mercy of Burying the Dead is really a discussion about faith and evangelization.
The people at Holy Cross Cemetery say what happened here this November was good for their loved ones and them as well.
To put someone to rest, I mean, this is biblical, and it's peaceful.
Today's event was very touching. I will remember it for as long as I live. And those who leave those ashes on top of a fireplace will never get to experience what I experienced today.
Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
In his reporting, Mark found that cremation rates are exceeding 60% in the U.S., and that is projected to rise to more than 80% by the year 2045. The CEO of Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services says it will support dioceses free of charge to implement programs to ensure ashes can be properly interred. You can visit the group's website at cfcsmission.org for more information. And now, before we close, let's get a little on the lighter side. Last weekend, on All Hallows Eve, among the usual ghosts and goblins and action figures walking the neighborhood with their candy buckets, were some children who had some heavenly inspiration for their costumes. If your children opted to honor the communion of the saints for All Saints Day by dressing as holy men and women, we asked you to send us your snapshots. In this week's Images of the Week, we spotlight a sampling of your viewer submissions. Last little one was my own daughter. This mama couldn't resist trying to instill in her a devotion to St. Catherine of Siena already. May all the holy men and women inspire us. And that's it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.